You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly brought to you by Shox Bone Conduction Headphones. Shox are comfortable, they give great sound quality, and they can solve some of the issues that can arise from wearing the more conventional earbud-style headphones while exercising, and that's that they can get a little bit sweaty and slippery and start to feel uncomfortable after a while. Well, there's none of those issues with Shox because the sound passes through the bones behind your ears, leaving your ears free, and the sound quality itself really has to be heard to be believed. Shox are used by several leading athletes, including Eliud Kipchoge and Eilish McColgan, and very soon, our very own Larry Warbass too. We know that lots of listeners have been taking advantage of the discount code CYCLING10 to get £10 off any purchase at uk.shox.com. Every purchase made using that discount code supports the Cycling Podcast too, so thank you very much to anyone who has bought a set of headphones recently. This week we've got a competition to win a set of Shox headphones, the flagship Open Run Pro 2 model. All you have to do is answer a very easy question. Stand by for that in a moment. Lately we've also had some really nice feedback on Instagram from some listeners. David Owen said he's used Shox headphones for years and describes them as absolutely game-changingly good. Thanks for the endorsement, David. Meanwhile, Adam Coatham said, I've been using a pair of Shox for a couple of years now. They're a really great kit and it's brilliant how they keep your ears wide open to your surroundings. Definitely recommend them. Thanks for that, Adam. Well, the Motown maestro, Larry Warbass, contacted Podcast HQ earlier this week with his Christmas list. We can't stretch to everything on your list, Larry, but we can sort you out with a set of Shox headphones, and they'll be winging their way to your Nice Hideaway very shortly. Perhaps we should have just told Larry to enter the competition like everyone else, but speaking of which, we've got a pair of Open Run Pro 2 headphones to win. You just have to answer this ludicrously easy question by email to stand a chance. Tadej Pogacar this season completed the so-called Triple Crown, winning the Giro, Tour and World Championships. But which two men had previously won this treble, and which years did they do it? Email your answer to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com with the subject title Shox Competition. We'll select a correct answer and announce the winner next week. In the meantime, there are some great Christmas offers available at uk.shox.com and the discount code CYCLING10 gets an additional £10 off. Now it's over to Daniel for the latest instalment of our review of 2024.
Hello, and joining you on December the 4th, a birthday shared by Jay-Z, another famous Jay, Joop Zoetemelk, and another not-so-famous Dutch former pro rider, Bram Tankink, who once expounded a highly unorthodox reincarnationist theory to the Cycling Podcast.
And then someone told me that as a rider, when you die, you get reincarnated as a cow. Then when I see the cows, I think, these are all ex-riders, you know, but they don't have to suffer at least anymore.
My name is Daniel Freiber, and I'm your host today as we wish Bram, Joop, and Mr. Z many happy returns. And as we give you, our listeners, the latest in our review of 2024 episodes, after our farewells episode a fortnight ago this week, the first week of December, appropriately, it is time for what we are calling our Advent episode. And that means it will be dedicated to riders who well and truly arrived, broke through, emerged, went bang in 2024. We were tempted to call it the Nativity episode, but we didn't want people tuning in thinking that we dressed Larry Warbass in a smock and made him sleep in a stable after his controversial outburst last week. Though I think our former friends at Escape Collective would have been quite happy to see him banished. If you know and listen to last week's episode, you know. As with all of our Review of the Year episodes, I'll briefly fill you in on the week's news headlines before we find room at the inn for two guests, Rob Hatch and young Richard Abraham, plus an exciting addition to the cast, a sort of donkey assisting us on our journey. More about him shortly. First, the racing. In cyclocross, the World Cup visited Dublin, Ireland of all places. Victories in the men's and women's races respectively, going much more conventionally to a Belgian, Michael van Hoorenhout, and a Dutch woman, Lucinda Brandt. Those two riders also lead the World Cup standings after two rounds, in Brandt's case jointly with compatriot Fem van Empel. Switching surfaces from turf to timber, On the track, the Champions League was in Apeldoorn in the Netherlands. At the end of 2 days, Harry Laverazen narrowly leads his British rival Matt Richardson in the men's track standings, while Dylan Bick of Canada is on top in the endurance events. In the women's endurance, Katie Archibald has a very commanding lead with just the London leg to go, and the same can be said of Alina Lysenko in the sprint events. It's a big week for World Tour training camps with various teams beginning to assemble. But one rider whose 2025 prep has already suffered a serious setback is Remco Evenepoel. The double Olympic champion was training in Belgium on Tuesday when a postman doored him, causing Evenepoel fractures of the shoulder blade, hand and a rib. We believe he'll be out of action for several weeks. Also, when this episode was put to bed, there was no timeline on the likely denouement of a story that's kept us intrigued this winter, i.e. Tom Pidcock's rumoured move from Ineos Grenadiers to Q36.5. Good sources suggest the transfer could certainly be back on the cards, and spies have also claimed Pidcock was not present at Ineos's training camp on the Costa Blanca earlier this week. Well, not present yet, anyway. In other want-away puncher news, Maxim Van Gils and his agent have finally managed to negotiate Van Gils' way out of his contract with Lotto Destiny. He has been heavily linked to Red Bull Bora. It also caught a few people's attention, though, that Astana seemed to free up two places in their roster by moving two World Tour riders onto their development team. Watch this space. Talking of decamping, it's now been confirmed that the Vuelta a España will emigrate to Italy for the race's Gran Salida in 2025. The third Grand Tour of the year will start in the Piemonte region, Turin to be precise, and there'll be one flat stage, summit finish, and a sort of hillier one before an alpine crossing into France. The race will make its return to Spain for stage five. Lastly, an old friend of the cycling podcast and former World Tour rider Harry Tamfield has reacted to the demise of the British Conti Division team Sampirin with the promise that he and his brother Charlie will try to secure backing for a new outfit, what would be the sole British representative in the Continental Division in 2025, with Trinity Racing also having shut down. I spoke to Harry earlier this week about what is a race against time.
We've got like a not a bad little tour all ticket along, but it's not going to get us a UCI license, that's for sure. So we're still trying to open doors and get into some conversations with big firms, and we've got a few leads that we're following up on at the moment still that, you know, they've shown a lot of interest and stuff, but they really need more key information about, you know, kind of cycling in the UK in general. We've got a couple more meetings lined up this week. Given the circumstances, I think it's probably better to extend the deadline even by a couple more weeks and actually have a British team for under 23 riders to go to, because, like, there's nothing. There's some club teams, but they're all full. So there's nowhere for under 23 guys to, you know, to progress once they leave the junior system. I mean, if they're good enough, they can go abroad directly after being juniors, but, you know, why should you send the juniors directly abroad from that point? It's really sad, really. I get a lot of messages from young guys that just want to, if we get it off the ground, that they want to join the team, obviously, but, you know, I can't have a team of 50 guys as well. It's also quite hard on that front. But obviously we intend to fully support the UK National Series with what's left of it, which is obviously one day race and about five road races. And like, the Criterium Series can be really cool for our partners. You know, it's something that it's not going to turn the lads pro that want to, you know, progress, but there's the UK National Crit Series as well, so to support that, and, you know, you've got the national championships and things, but outside of that, we're just looking to go to Europe as much as possible, but the issue being budget, that's the constraint. We want to try as the bare minimum to do a tour and at least a one-day race or two one-day races and a small tour, like a 2-3-4-day race abroad, at least every month. BC want a lot of money for us to hit that budget target, and yeah, I mean, it can probably be run for a bit less. I guess you have to do a budget for the worst case scenario, which obviously means you need to put a lot more down there than what is probably required. But we are looking for, certainly a minimum of 250k to go forward with. Realistically, maybe a bit, you know, we do need a bit more, really. But I think BC would maybe, we'd have to do a costings plan, obviously, based on the race calendar and cut some races out back. And again, it's just giving the lads opportunity.
That was Harry Tamfield, great character, HT, who conquered a lot of hearts, if not races, in his three seasons in the World Tour. If you are interested in helping Harry and what may become Team Tanfield, or know someone who can, simply slide into his DMs on Instagram, he says. Two final things from me next week. In fact, on Thursday, the 12th of December, I am going to be doing a Christmas Kilometre Zero live with Rob Hatch and other familiar names and faces from the Cycling Podcast family. All friends of the podcast will be getting an email about how to participate in that. And to become a friend of the podcast, head to thecyclingpodcast.com or thecyclingpodcast.supportingcast, that's all one word, .fm, where you'll find info. You'll also find info on how to buy someone Cycling Podcast friendship for Christmas. Details also in the show notes. Very last thing for UK listeners, we and our good friend Greg Andrews of Divine Cellars have curated six of the festive best case of wines. That is six wines that didn't quite make it into our three Grand Tour cases, but could have, maybe should have, earlier in the year. To order, head to divinecellars.com. That's Divine Cellars, all one word, the letter D, then Vine, then Cellars, all one word, .com, or look for the link in the show notes.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by MAP.
The Cycling Podcast is also supported by MAP, the Melbourne-based clothing company who have supported the Cycling Podcast for the past three seasons, and we're very grateful to them for that support. It's been a busy few weeks for MAP because they've just launched the Off the Map Tour 24 powered by Zwift. That's live now, and if you complete each of the three stages between now and December the 22nd, you can unlock some fantastic rewards and join the likes of Freddie Ovette and Quek Shio on the road, or should I say the virtual road. This year's tour also includes a never-before-ridden route, so that's an added incentive to saddle up for the Off the Map Tour 24 powered by Zwift. More details about that available on MAP's website, map.cc. And while you're there, check out the new collaboration between MAP and our very good friend of the podcast, Mitch Docker. The MAP Life in the Peloton kit has recently been unveiled and is available now. And very smart it looks too. If you've already got the Cycling Podcast kit, which came out a couple of years or so ago, it's kind of a companion piece, really. There's a few similarities. They certainly don't look too dissimilar from one another in that they come from the same stable. So you could alternate between your Cycling Podcast kit and your Life in the Peloton kit very happily. Sticking with cycling, the 12 Hills of Christmas ride that Laurent Audibert, friend of the podcast, Laurent Audibert, is organising. It's on Sunday morning, December the 8th, leaving from the Hub Cafe in Redbourne High Street at 9 a.m. That's the Hub Cafe in Redbourne High Street, Hertfordshire. Laurent would love to see loads of you there to join him for the 12 Hills of Christmas. And if you can't make that because you're not near Hertfordshire, another friend of the podcast, David Owen, has organised a virtual 12 Hills of Christmas ride on Zwift for noon UK time on Saturday, December the 14th. Check out the details of that in the next 1101 Cappuccino, which you can sign up for at thecyclingpodcast.com. And before I hand back to Daniel, a quick reminder that we recently opened our virtual pub, The Cannibal and Badger, which is an old school lo-fi forum to discuss cycling and the podcast. And it's exclusively open to friends of the podcast, and you can join the conversation by logging into your friends of the podcast account by following the link on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. Daniel and I have completed the icebreaker, the introduce yourself thread. Very nice to read all of your entries on that thread. Feel like I'm getting to know some of our regulars a little bit better by reading through those. So go and check out The Cannibal and Badger. But now it really is back to Daniel and co for the rest of the episode.
Young Richard Abraham, Merry Christmas, Advent. Have you got an advent calendar?
Not yet.
No.
I can see the top of a what looks like a Christmas tree where you are, Daniel.
Yes. You're probably young enough to still believe in Father Christmas, so we won't ruin that for you. I do have an advent calendar. I don't really eat chocolate, but my fiance's mother very sweetly insists that we get a joint advent calendar. So she sent one the other day, so that we've got chocolates every day, which I don't eat, so which I sort of have to palm off every day. But yeah, I do have one. And there's a Christmas tree as well behind me. Rob Hatch, I know that he does eat chocolate. I can confirm that, having lived with him for a few years back in the day. Rob is old enough not to believe in Father Christmas. Rob, how are you?
Boo. But do you know what? You have to believe, otherwise you won't get anything. I'll get coal, won't I? Sack of coal on Christmas Day. I can't be having that. And there will be a Christmas tree up here soon, but there isn't yet. I've got it on order. It's coming next week. How about that?
Excellent, excellent news. Well, I'll be there next week, Rob. I'll be there next week.
Exactly. I've just got it for you, that's all.
Yeah, as mentioned, or as hinted, as alluded to in the intro to today's episode, also alluded to, chaps, in the intro to today's episode, was a not yet breaking story, but in the intervening period has become a bit of a breaking story, because I talked about Tom Pidcock and rumours intensifying that his on-off move to Q36.5 might be on again. Apparently it is on again. By the time this episode goes live, it might be very much, well, not only on, but done, chaps.
Will there be a yellow ticker up across the screen?
Here we
go. Has he issued a come and get me plea?
Fabrizio Romano might have tweeted by the time we hit the airwaves tonight. Chaps, let's try not to alienate our listeners with too many more football references. It is the Advent episode. What does that mean? Well, I've already explained it in the intro. We're going to be talking about breakthroughs, things, people, mainly people, maybe riders, that arrived in a big way, in a major way in 2024, our breakout riders. It is going to be an unconventional, all of our episodes are a little bit unconventional. We're iconoclastic. We break the mold in various different ways. And but today's episode, particularly, because also alluded to in the intro, was that we've got a sort of fourth wheel, kind of rickety fourth wheel for today's podcast. Killian Kelly is a name that might be familiar to some listeners from where, Rob? Social media and GCN.
Yeah, and he gets the odd bit of mention on our commentary, because very often towards the end of the day, my phone starts pinging and Killian's sending over some wonderful, weird stat that nobody else would even dare to investigate or think of.
Well, you're very complimentary there. He sends you some wonderful, weird stats. He's been burning down my phone, chaps, asking me to get on the Beyond the Cycling podcast. And I finally, reluctantly agreed. He sent me a message last week, "Coach, put me on the field." he then declared his inavailability for any of the proposed recording times. So I said, "Killian, how about we do something else and you pre-record something? Let's go for something conceptual. How about a breakthrough themed advent calendar?"
Which did he bring any chocolate, by the way?
No, I don't think so. But he might need consoling, Rob, tonight, because I think he's also a Manchester United fan. Hopefully we'll need consoling tonight. So maybe he can do that with some chocolate. But Killian has obliged, and his advent calendar is going to form some kind of shambolic structure around which we will construct today's episode, talking about breakthrough riders. He's been given 24 windows behind which there is something or someone who either broke through in 2024, or a statistic pertaining to, relating to breakthroughs. So, chaps, should we see what he's conjured up for us? Without further ado, let's go to the first five windows, I think, starting on December the 1st. Here is Killian and his advent calendar.
Okay, here we go. So behind door number one on the Cycling Podcast advent calendar. Oh, look, it's Rude Hullett sitting on a shed. Father Ted joke there. Anyone? No? Okay, behind actual door number one is Paul Manier, who won his first race of the season at the first time of asking for his new team, Soudal Quickstep, at the Challenge Mallorca back in January. But it wasn't just his first race for that team. It was his first race as a pro ever. Manier is the first rider to do that since Fernando Gaviria in 2015. Behind door number two is Isaac Del Toro. It took just two World Tour race days into his fledgling career to win his first World Tour race, a stage at the Tour Down Under. Only Matthew Van Der Poel had managed a World Tour race win in this few race days. Door number three contains Matteo Jorgensen, who wore number three at the Tour de France this year, undoubtedly one of the breakthrough riders of the year. He finished in 8th place at the Tour, the first American in the Tour top 10 for 10 years. The last was TJ Van Garderen in 2014. Behind door number 4 is Leonard van Eetveld. 4 is the number of stage races that van Eetveld took part in this year, and he won 2 of them, the Tour of Guangxi and the UAE Tour. It was also stage number 4 at the Vuelta that he made an absolute horlicks of by celebrating too early, gifting the stage win to Primoz Roglic. And behind door number 5 is Lenny Martinez. He won 5 one-day races in 2024. Only Tadej Pogacar won more one-day races this year. Also lurking alongside Martinez behind door number 5 is Antonio Morgado, who finished in 5th place at the Tour of Flanders, the only rider younger than Morgado to finish top 5 in a World Tour one day race in the past 20 years was Remco Evenepoel at San Sebastian in 2019.
So fellas, before we specifically dig into what Kilian has come up with there, I was going to ask you, and I forgot to ask you in the intro to today's episode, or just when I welcomed you in today, and breakthroughs in general in 2024. This has been a big subject for a few years now, hasn't it? Young riders bursting onto the scene ever more precociously. But does it feel, before you really dug into the homework that I set you for this week, off the top of your head, did you feel as though this had been a big year for breakthroughs, new riders, near pros?
Yes. The reason being, it started off really, really quickly, didn't it? At the start of the season, you had all these new names, and straight away, as you find out, and I'll tell you what, there's no chocolate there, but there's plenty of gold there from Kilian, wasn't there? Absolutely brilliant stuff. Love listening to his delivery there and all the nuggets he's brought along. But to me, some of those names that he just mentioned already were winning right from the start, weren't they? They were there right from the start. Del Toro being the best example already at the Tour Down Under. So for me, difficult to quantify, isn't it? You want to go on how many riders broke through, what they achieved. We'd be here all day doing that. But the general consensus and sort of mood that was created from watching all the early races were, wow, who are all these kids who are just winning straight away?
And there was a point, when was it, April, when there was that Tour of the Basque Country crash that took out Remco, Vingegaard, remind me who else, Roglic.
Steph Kras. Don't forget him.
Jay Vine.
And then the Dauphiné, what, a couple of months, and it almost went a bit Mitch then, didn't I, the Dauphiné, was a couple of months later, and what, Derek G had a really good performance, Matteo Jorgensen had a really good performance, and it's kind of sort of looked like, maybe this is going to be like that breakthrough year is going to continue. And then the Tour de France came, and it was Pogacar and the rest, you know. And then I think at that point, all of those riders who had sort of poked their noses above the parapet of the sport in that first, you know, first 6 months or so, it sort of dropped off then. Like Remco Evenepoel wiped the floor in the Olympics, didn't he? We should mention Remco in the news, hasn't he?
He has been mentioned, Richard.
Back in hospital, back in the Herentals orthopedics clinic, where every Belgian and every possibly other Northern European rider goes when they break a bone.
Bit of a breakthrough in terms of media coverage for the Herentals orthopedic department this year. They got a lot of coverage, didn't they? But chaps, I get what you're saying, and you're certainly right, Rob. That was from Isaac Del Toro. That was definitely one of the most eye-catching results, breakthroughs of the early season, wasn't it? However, like a lot of young riders, he had a sort of second half of the season that sort of tailed off a little bit. Fizzled a little bit by the very high standards of the first few months of the season. Of course, he won in Australia. He won the Vuelta a Asturias. For my money, maybe his most impressive performances of the early year were 4th in Tirreno and 7th in Tour of the Basque Country, which is an incredibly hard race. Then in the second half of the season, he had Vuelta a España, which some of us thought may have looked like Tadej Pogacar's Vuelta a España in 2019. That sensational debut Grand Tour where Pogacar won 3 stages. But Del Toro had a few issues, didn't he? As UAE in general had issues, illness, crashes, so on and so forth. And you know, we spoke to him a few times in the Vuelta, and he was having a bit of a torrid time for phases of the Vuelta, had various health problems. He sort of recovered a bit in the second half with three big breakaways, 100 kilometer plus breakaways. But this is a bit of a pattern with the young riders. I feel that they tend to thrive in the first months of the season, and maybe it's to be expected that they either get tired or they are so motivated when they start, particularly their neo-pro season, that it is simply unsustainable. And I do feel that was the case. I mean, Lenny Martinez, Killian also mentioned there, his season soured slightly, or started to go in the wrong direction around about the time it became public knowledge that he was leaving Groupama. And they then railroaded him towards the Tour de France, which he wasn't originally supposed to do. So up until the Tour de Romandie, he was brilliant. And then they sent him to the Tour de France via the Tour de Suisse. And after that, he seemed to struggle a bit. But that was a bit of a theme for my money.
Hmm. Yeah, Laurence Pithy, I think we'll mention him maybe a bit later, but he's one who comes to mind there as well. He was on fire again. Transfer rumours.
Exactly.
Announced
same
that he was
team
going somewhere else. But I think that happens as well, doesn't it, when you're an experienced rider. You know, you can be, you talked about railroaded to the Tour, they often even just put you into the sidings, don't you? You don't see riders really racing too much more again later in the season. So at least they were out there and they were racing, to Groupama's credit on that front. But in terms of the prep and the plan that Martinez would have had, it probably did look different when it was all announced, and they were sitting down at this time of year at the first training camp, probably.
I was shocked, Rob, and I mentioned it in the intro to today's episode. I was shocked by Larry's outburst last week, the famous, the infamous one. I think you know the one I'm referring to, directed at some of our colleagues. But I'd also forgotten the shocking moment when I asked Larry about Lawson Craddock's season. No, maybe this was 2 weeks ago. And I pointed out that Lawson Craddock had a few DNFs in the second half of the season. And Larry said something along the lines of, were they not more CBFs? And I sort of looked quizzically at Larry. And Larry went on to explain that CBF is an acronym that stands for can't be something. Obviously meant in half jest. And I don't think...
The sort of thing that they can say, but we can't. Yeah, no.
And I don't think that applies to Lenny Martinez and Laurence Pithy. Does it? Hopefully not.
No, not at that stage in their career, you wouldn't imagine.
Chaps, should we get to the second batch of dates?
Yeah, let's have more Killian. I just want to sit back and listen to his Jack and Ori Christmas story.
Windows 6 to the 10th. Take us, Killian, from the 6th of December in the future now to the 10th of December.
Reaching for the calendar again, I'm going to cheat and do what I always tell my kids not to do and open two doors at the same time. Doors 6 and 7. 67, as in 1967. And who have we got? Eddie Merckx. Merckx rode in his first Grand Tour in 1967, the Giro d'Italia, and he didn't win it. Despite all the amazing breakthrough riders we've had over the past few years, Pogge, Vingegaard, Evenepoel, just like Merckx, none of them won their first Grand Tour. Very few riders do. In the past 60 years, only Bernardino has done it. Behind door number 8 is a big gang of riders, 8 of them, naturally. This is the number of riders younger than 22 who won World Tour races in 2024. Juan Ayuso, Pavel Bittner, Isaac Del Toro, Romain Grégoire, Thibaut Nice, Oscar Onley, Laurence Pithy and Alex Sejar. Is that a giant chin dimple peeking out behind door number 9? Yes, it's Cadel Evans. It's 9 years now since the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race made its first appearance on the calendar, and therefore 9 years since Cadel Evans retired. And Evans's eponymous race was won this year by breakthrough rider Laurence Pithy. And door number 10 is a big one, because behind this door we have the entire Pyrenean mountain range, because it was 1910 when the Pyrenees first broke through into the Tour de France and appeared on the route for the very first time.
Well, chaps, more pearls of festive wisdom and insight there from Killian. Some interesting stuff there. Only Bernard Hinault has won his first Grand Tour of, was it the only rider in history to win his first Grand Tour. That was an interesting fact, something we probably all knew, but Good to be reminded of it. Eight riders under the age of 22 winning World Tour races in 2024, including Bittner, Onley, Pithy. We've mentioned, well, we certainly mentioned Pithy already. We're going to talk about Oscar Onley in a little while. Pithy, Rob, you mentioned him. We spoke to him a bit at the Giro d'Italia. That was his first Grand Tour, and he had some issues there. He had a bad crash in Paris-Roubaix, didn't he? He hurt his knee. He finished seventh in Paris-Roubaix, but he also hurt his knee, and that really impacted his preparation for the Giro d'Italia, and he suffered in the first half. But anything there, chaps?
Let's not forget, Daniel, as well, that, sorry, let's not forget that he was going since the New Zealand part of the season and the Australian part of the season. He won Groupama's first road race of the season, which was the Cadel Evans race down there. Just nudged ahead of Natnel Tesfatsion back at the start of the season to get that victory. And it sort of set the tone then for him to go straight onto the classics. Bahainisi was excellent, wasn't he? Down there. And then another one, rather like Matteo Jorgensen, resident in southern France, so he was riding home. Had a really good time of it, but because of that success, and as we mentioned, sort of then it started to become clear that he was going to be moving on, he was thrown straight into the Giro. You add the injury into that, he didn't really have a break, did he? So probably only natural that he didn't deal with that well.
You just reminded me of something, my favourite story from about Laurence Pithy this year, confirmed by him to me at Paris-Nice, was that I think he's talked about this in other interviews, that there is a video of him just after he was born, having just been taken home, I think, to his parents' home, and you can hear the Tour de France commentary from the Tour de France in the background because he was born during the Tour de France. Richard, anything there, or would you like to tell us what we're about to hear about one team, DSM Firmenich Post NL, who I think deserve a lot of credit for furnishing us with breakthrough riders most years, really. They are very successful at and renowned for their development of young riders.
They are. And, well, the person who we're about to hear from is kind of quite important in that. Matt Winston, who's the sports director and coach there now, used to be, well, I first encountered him when he was a coach and sort of overall mentor on the Olympic Development Programme, which was the junior setup for the British national team. And this would have been probably 10 years ago, I think, and when his intake at that point, Theo Gegenhardt was up there, Lucy Garner, I think one of the kind of alumni of that sort of era when he was working there. Anyway, and DSM, apart from the obvious standout performances, they've kind of backed it up in that their younger riders, or youngest riders, have been there consistently, their best performers this year, apart from Romain Bardet being the obvious exception there, who's going to retire next year. And Bardet was the outlier in that he got the team's sort of biggest world tour performances. Was he second at Liège, wasn't he? And
yeah,
I can't remember exactly where in the Giro, top 10, but sort of a player
ninth
in the GC at the Giro, and of course in the yellow jersey at the Tour. So apart from him, it really was a sort of story of youth. And well, I spoke to Matt Winston. Unfortunately, I wasn't recording when the bit where Matt was describing where he was. You guys admonished me, or I think Daniel, you did, for the fish and chips restaurant reference the other week for the British. But we had Matt was driving around Birmingham and ended up outside a Holiday Inn Express and a Harvester or something, which was a sort of extremely accidental partridge. But anyway, we'll hear from Matt, shall we?
Yeah, I think kind of. For us as a team, we've been kind of building towards this for a few years with these guys, and yeah, they've come through our development team also. So we've kind of been working with most of them since they were kind of 18, 19 years old. Sometimes even maybe a little bit younger, just as they're kind of, we're giving them some advice as they come out of that junior into the transition of turning under 23. So for us as a team, we kind of, it kind of wasn't unexpected, and I think kind of once one of them wins, they're quite a close knit group together. So then they just kind of urge each other on a little bit, and you get that kind of inter team kind of spirit there, where these young lads are all now starting to make that step up, and the first guy wins, and then the next guy also, he's like, "Whoa, yeah, when he can do it, then I can also do it." And yeah, the momentum starts to build them.
Do you think have they all got something in common between the group of them that has allowed them to unlock that success this year?
Well, I think kind of like when they were on the development team, they lived together, we have like houses over in Sittard, where in our Keep Challenging Centre, which kind of the team built a number of years ago now, where the guys kind of like, they have their own apartment there, but it's all on the same street. So you've got kind of like a group of guys all living together. The women's team also some of the women's team live there, and they're kind of going out training together every day. They're talking about when they've been on races and they come home and like their experiences together. So they're kind of living and breathing it, and they've gone off into kind of a little bit separate directions, but a lot of them still, they don't live in Sittard anymore, but they live quite close to each other, and they still have, I think, the same way of working. They'll go out training together, they'll stop for a coffee together, even though, like you say, they're different types of riders. So they're kind of just like living and breathing together, cycling and enjoying kind of what they're doing, and kind of I think that's one of the most important things, and that's been probably one of the reasons it's been successful over the last kind of 12 months, because they're now ready to start breaking through, and they're ready to start winning those races. They've learned a lot. And these guys are not guys that are necessarily all from the same country either. So they're, you know, like you listed the names before, but you've got Czech rider there, you've got Danish riders, British riders, Dutch riders, kind of, and they're all kind of just chipping away together and enjoying being bike riders.
What's been the key for them in making that step up? Has it been that the team has given them positions of leadership and responsibility and then supported them in that, that's allowed them to start achieving successes? Or is it maybe been just a sort of natural physical development or evolution psychologically or mentally as riders? What's happened this year that's allowed that?
I think kind of all of the points that you list, to be honest. Like the team, obviously now we see they're in a position where they can start to do that. Physically, they've reached a point where they're able to win races and on the highest level. Mentally, they're of an age where they really understand kind of how to win those races in terms of kind of what it takes to be professional every day and kind of keep growing in that capacity and evaluating themselves. And they're all hungry. So also when they don't win, it's not like it's just, you didn't win. We evaluate it, we look at it, we learn from it. And then we looked as a whole team to then put the processes in place that in the next race, they can then go and achieve a better result. And that's what we've been doing with those guys for the last kind of 3-4 years. And like you say, now we've come to a point where they've started to win races. Mm-hmm. It was nice that we won kind of the most races we've won quite a number of years in the last season. Now what we have to do also to keep moving that momentum forward, it's nice that we're winning point one races and point pro races, but we got to also turn some of those into World Tour wins, or a few more of them into World Tour wins. Obviously kind of Pavel in the Vuelta did a great job there, and Oscar Onley down in Australia. But when we can start to maybe make 3 or 4 more of those victories into World Tour wins, then I think we'll really make that next step. I think kind of bike riders, they feed off kind of the success and the momentum that they get from victories, and they show themselves, they prove to themselves. Sometimes they're their biggest doubters. Can I actually win a bike race? And the team is totally behind them. We know these guys are super talented, and they maybe doubt themselves a little bit and search a little bit for that first victory. But once that starts to come, then it starts to come a little bit easier in some respects. Like the first victory is probably the hardest victory to get, and then the momentum starts to come, and I think we'll see that next year getting carried forward, and I'm confident these guys can keep making those steps.
And these guys are all under 23 or 23 and under, which actually not that long ago would have been classed as young, and they're all still they'd still be eligible for, you know, the young rider classification in most races. But actually, has the sport changed now, do you think, to an extent where that's no longer young in the sense that their physical peak or the peak of their performances might actually be coming a little bit earlier, and we should perhaps sort of not really consider them, especially young riders, anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you guys have talked about it in the past on previous episodes and stuff. But for me, I think kind of I was the junior national coach between kind of 2012 and 2014 as part of kind of one of various roles at British Cycling. And there we were when we were coaching guys like Theo Gegenhardt, Eleanor Barker, Lucy Garner. We were coaching very much on feel. We used some heart rate. But it was a lot about learning the sport and just learning how to ride your bike. And they come on camps and we'd work them hard for 6 days, and then they kind of go home and then do little bits of top up in between. Whereas now the way the cycling has changed, you have kind of 15, 16 year old riders, sometimes even younger, that are already working with power meters, already working with nutritionists, already working with good coaches to develop them. So that then increases performance at the younger level, just because they're training like professionals, which those guys did back in the day. They trained hard, but they weren't training like professionals train today. So even when the academy first started, they were using SRMs for kind of testing and stuff, but they weren't and using it a bit. But now everything is kind of driven by the science, where when those guys came through and took longer then to develop at the into the late 20s, early 30s, when they then started to win races, that was the time, I guess, that they need to then come into being professional at that high level. Whereas now we get 18-year-olds that are super well-trained and they're already professional athletes.
Has that changed your job and what you look for in a young rider? Maybe a little bit further back in that progression, you know, when they're coming onto the development team, or what your sort of the attributes you think might make them good professional riders in the world tour a bit later down the line, you know, because the level is uniformly higher in terms of, you know, like the, let's say the scientific or the professionalism of their training. Are you looking more at the mental side of things and those aspects of the individuals?
Yeah, I think kind of physically now their ceiling is just higher. So kind of what guys can do is just higher now. And through technology, but also, like I just said, through the advancement in training, we look at the whole round package. So we, for sure, for us, the psychological part and the mental aspect is really important when we're looking at young riders. Do they fit in the team? Do they want to kind of come in into our way of working? That forms one part of many parts that we look at when we're looking at riders. And, you know, we now also with recruitment, like back in the day, like, again, it's been widely reported, like, professionals would be at the Tour de France or around the Tour de France, would be making their contracts for the next year and all that kind of stuff. Now, even with our development team, in February, March, April, sometimes even earlier, sometimes already a year and a half out from them being 18, we're already speaking with them. We're already working on those contracts, what that looks like, and do they fit and how do they fit? So everything is now worked on way more in advance than kind of back in the day, where you just tick along and yeah, you come to July with your fixed World Tour riders in July, maybe then kind of your newer guys in August and then your Devos in September, October. That's just totally out of the window now. We have to work a lot further in front now than we used to before, but everyone else is doing the same. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to be at the front of where you need to be. And I think guys can look at our development team and say that is a good place to go. We are developing riders, and I think kind of this year we proved that by the fact that so many guys stepped up this year and won. And we sign riders for the development team, not just to be on the development team. We sign them because we want them to progress to the World Tour. That's kind of and those riders obviously also want to progress to the World Tour. So we have a shared goal in terms of, right, we need to really work together, make you the best that you can be so you can make those steps. And when you make those steps into the World Tour, can you just kind of go in there and then already start on a good level? So guys that we bring or we're looking at bringing in, we'll use in the World Tour team in the year or two before as well. So they get that experience riding already with guys like Romain Bardet. Like Tour des Alpes is a good example. We won that race a few years ago, but we often have one or two development riders at the Tour of the Alps with us. So they're directly there with the core squad that's preparing to go to the Giro 1 week later. That those guys are already experiencing the final part of preparation of how you go to the Giro. So they're already getting the taste and the flavour of how that feels.
Is there a particular rider this year? I don't want to force you to choose between all the different riders that are on your team that you coach and manage, but was there a particular performance, or it doesn't even have to be a win? You know, I think to how close Max Poel came to victory in the Vuelta, for example, kind of time and time again, but you know, a particular ride that really stood out to you as one that you were particularly proud of or impressed by?
I think we've done some quite nice things this year as a team, and I think kind of for me what I enjoy seeing is also kind of like how guys like Romain Bardet, also Warren Barguil, John Degenkolb, they're all the statesmen of the team, guys that have been around the team a long time, are also enjoying putting a lot back into our younger guys. Like you see Warren in the Tour of Denmark working tirelessly on the front, also in Croatia the same for these young guys, and he's a guy that has been competing in the front of stage in the Tour de France in the last 1 or 2 years, and you see they've been riding on the front for 100k in Croatia to set up guys to go for victory. So I think kind of the spirit that those guys have and the investment the older guys have into helping develop this young talent, for me, I think that's that makes me proud to work with the team as a whole. And when we can continue to do that and continue to bring those experiences to each other, then yeah, I think we'll keep stepping forward. I think kind of the one thing kind of young riders have to do is just always keep taking it in steps. So you can't, I guess, rush like in some respects, and you can very quickly come up, and you see it often where guys are like on the cusp and on the breakthrough, and then all of a sudden they just fizzle away a little bit, and they're not able to make that final step where they're then winning week in, week out. And I think that's where, certainly with the guys that I work with, we look to manage kind of that expectation and kind of protect them a little bit and make sure that they don't go too quickly in kind of off the edge if they don't win. You know, so if they turn up in January, February, March and they don't get a win in those first 3 months, then, okay, what do we do? How do we do it? Don't go panicking. But I think kind of a guy like Tobias Lund Andersen, I think, is an exciting prospect to look out for next year. Kind of, he's proved already he can win sprints, and kind of directly he'll be looking to get stuck in from the start of the season. So yeah, I guess if I have to name one guy to keep an eye out for, then amongst all of the others, then he would be one.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
So speaks Matt Winston, the president of a Lancashire Cycling Club. He's got some beautiful, snazzy jerseys, of which one's sitting in my wardrobe.
I thought you were going to say cricket club there.
Well, no, he, to be fair, he's that much interest in it. Yeah, he could be the next Lancashire CC president. You never know. Watch this space. He's doing a good job with the cycling.
He occasionally brings, I don't know if it's occasionally, I think there might be a bat.
Oh, they've got a league going and everything.
Pads they've got permanently sort of, in the team bus.
Oh, yeah, they've got like Eastern European mechanics playing now. They've got people from all over the world who aren't from sort of, let's say, cricketing nations playing, and they've got a few other teams involved. It sounds, I mean, obviously we commentate the Tour de France remotely now, so we don't see this, but it sounds like the rest days are blinding down now, missing it, you know.
Well, DSM were dependable patrons of the rest day cricket match between press and team members. Yeah, there weren't any pads though. I don't think it was serious or fast enough for pads to be required for what and where we were playing. But yeah, Matt and Phil West were down there. Where were we the first rest day this year on the Tour de France?
Trois. I don't think you'd need. I don't think you'd need pads for Rob's dibbly dobblers anyway. Chaps, some interesting stuff there from Matt Winston. He sort of referred back to things that we've mentioned in the podcast at length, I suppose, ad infinitum in some cases. Over the last few years, just the availability of sort of data, good feedback that is informing young riders' training and so on and so forth, and that's led to more precocious riders, precocious sort of breakthroughs, results. I think that this is a team, as I said before, that doesn't really get enough credit. I think the very nature of what they try to do, and there is a sort of preponderance of young riders, actually. You know, if you look at the roster, there are maybe more experienced riders than you might imagine, but there still, over the years, have been a lot of very, very young riders. I think by its nature, if you run a program like that, it's going to be sort of fickle and inconsistent. And they have had years that have been a lot leaner than this year in terms of victories, 22 victories, as I said, this year. I feel as though quite a lot of what they tried this year worked. And on other occasions, it hasn't. But as we've said many times on the podcast, they are a team that goes to every race with a plan, an objective, a goal. And sometimes those objectives are not things you would even, not things that are quantifiable on pro cycling stats, or, you know, if you look at the results, they can be as simple as such and such a rider's job at a certain race is to get to a certain point on the course or position a leader at a certain point. And if they do that, then everyone can sort of rub their hands and say, well done, and off they go to the next one. But it's all very intentional is what I'm trying to say. There's nothing sort of tippy-tappy or wishy-washy about it.
Clear tactical plans that they go into. And again, not always orthodox ones as well. I think we have to give them credit for trying things. Like you said, it doesn't always come off. I think there are there was one occasion, I can't remember which race it was, where it quite spectacularly didn't come off this year.
Was it the stage won by Georg Steinhauser at the Giro d'Italia? I mean, that's a good example, I suppose. That was a day when everyone was left scratching their head. I can't exactly remember the sort of configuration. Romain Bardet attacked that day. I remember it was on the penultimate climb, and in an effort to bridge to maybe, was it Chris Hamilton? And it didn't really work. But again, if you speak to someone like Matt Winston on a day like that, the story that he will tell and the explanation that he will give, it is very much at odds with what it looks like television, what it's sort of easy to criticise them for as a kind of armchair quarterback.
Yeah, and I know that I had a chat with Matt on that day, because quite understandably, on our coverage on the telly, there were people questioning, and the experts we sit next to are watching that and thinking, well, what's going on here? But unless you speak to the person and you then realise what their plan was, you're like, well, actually, yeah, if it had worked out the other way, we'd have all been sitting there saying, oh, what a genius piece of work. And yeah, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But let's give them the credit for that reason. I think that it does work sometimes, and, you know, they're not completely barking up the wrong tree when it doesn't work. There are options. There are different ways of approaching it. And when you don't have the budget of the big teams, when you don't have the ready-made riders, you have to do it differently, don't you? So I think, like you said, that team does deserve a heck of a lot of credit for getting through those years where it hasn't really worked, the lean years, for then having a year like this, like you said, 22 wins. When you stack their budget up against others, it's a very, very good return. That.
And probably a good illustration of the fact that developing riders isn't the same as them winning races. I mean, we're predominantly talking about youngish riders, although to what extent we call riders young anymore, or how young they have to be to qualify as young, I think is still changing. They've won races doesn't necessarily mean that they've developed, and likewise there'll be riders who we haven't really seen who will be developing, and will, for whom 2024 was a big year in terms of their development, but we just haven't seen that yet. We might see it next year or even further down the line.
I mean, you're about 45 and we still call you young, so yes, I think a great example of what this team is about and where they thrive, where they excel, was given by Jai Hindley in a podcast he did with Mitch Docker, when he just talked about the process of being signed by that team and how he was given quite a lot of responsibility quite early, quite surprisingly even for him, And so it has been for that team. And there's a real sort of culture, there's a real through line in that team that's been consistent for many, many years. As I say, I think they deserve some flowers for that, chaps. Should we go back to Killian and his advent calendar?
We're really getting going now. Behind door number 11 is a cohort of British riders. 11 is the number of British riders that were at the start of this year's Tour de France, the most ever, including breakthrough riders Oscar Onley and Stevie Williams. A rather strange fact, this one, given the horrific state of the British domestic scene currently. Door number 12 contains Florin Lipowitz. Lipowitz nabbed the 12th pro win for Germany this year by winning the GC at the Sibiu Tour in Romania. But, much like the British behind door number 11, this breakthrough by Lipowitz hides a German problem. They ended 2024 with the fewest number of wins for German riders since 1985. Behind unlucky door number 13, hang on a sec, I'll just turn the calendar upside down for this one. It's the Tour of Flanders and the year 1913. The Tour of Flanders was invented in 1913, the last of the monument classics to be invented, and all of a sudden, the five monuments were a thing. Except they weren't a thing, because the idea of monuments weren't invented yet. There's actually no such thing as a monument classic. Moving on to door number 14, and we have Derek G. His stage win in the Dauphiné was the 14th win for Canada at World Tour level since that level was invented in 2005. Michael Woods, Hugo Uhl, Ryder Hegedal, Francois Parisien, David Veilleux, and Swain Tuft all contributing. We're opening up door number 15 and peeking back to 15 years ago, which was the last time before 2024 that French riders won three stages of the Tour de France by stage 9 via Romain Bardet, Kevin Vauquelin and Anthony Turgis, with a massive assist on stage 1 by breakthrough rider Jürgen Vandenbroek, the first rider to wear the white jersey at the Tour in the post-Young Pog era.
So, fellas, a couple of my favourites, I would say, of the year. Favourite breakout stories there. Derek G, 27 years old, ninth in his very first Tour de France. Very consistent in the mountains he was there. This was after he finished third in the Dauphiné, of course. Had great fun at the Dauphiné, sort of prodding him every day, talking to him every day, encouraging him, egging him on to go for GC, not only in that race, but at the Dauphiné. And he's a guy who, you know, without being necessarily flamboyant or particularly extroverted in interviews, he's really captured people's imagination because there is just a sort of naivete about Derek G. And some of this is to do with where he comes from. He's sort of unconventional, kind of late bloomer type story, and the way he got into the World Tour, but he does embody this sort of beginner's mindset, very wide-eyed he seems, and that sort of brings him, I think, a lot of affection, a lot of support, has garnered him a lot of support, and it was great to see him thrive, really, particularly at the Dauphiné, as I said, but I think he surprised everyone, including himself, at the Tour de France, finishing ninth, having not initially believed that he was going to ride for GC, but then he had a great day on the Chemin Blanc in Troyes. I think he finished third that day, and that sort of put him back towards the top of GC. And on he went. The other one mentioned there, who I thought was worthy of a special mention, was Florian Lipowitz, who, Rob, we certainly encountered at the Vuelta a España in the last week. Was very much in the thick of things there. Was very much in the thick of things at the Giro d'Italia. Still a guy we don't know that much about. We know that he got into cycling because of a knee problem in biathlon. I didn't really realise. I've been doing some reading about just what a biathlon prodigy he was. He had this knee problem, gave up biathlon, started cycling. Now, I was reading race reports from these big biathlon races in Germany that he did when he was a 14-year-old, and he was beating the elites or finishing in the sort of top five of some of the best biathletes in Germany. And his brother, Philip, was the 2021 biathlon world champion. Wow. So that family, the Lipowitz family from down there in Baden-Württemberg, not far from Stuttgart, is a sort of biathlon dynasty. And it's going to be really interesting to see, well, first of all, which Grand Tour he gets sent to next year. I don't know about you chaps, but I've been hearing in the last few days that Primoz Roglic to the Giro d'Italia is a pretty sure bet now.
Oh, it's an intelligent decision as well, isn't it? Given where he is in his career and given the competition, you know, if he does have a wonderful year, we saw this year that nowadays, if you do it properly, Giro and Tour, you can be competitive in both if you're one of the top operators. And then, let's say, you know, he does well and wins another Giro, it's not quite pressure off at the Tour, is it? But it's already been a successful season then. So I think that's a clever way to go, certainly, about
it. Who's your favourite G? Derek G, Gina G, G Thomas, or Warren G? I used to have a bit of a soft spot for Gina G.
Did you? Anyway. Just a little bit?
Yeah. Wonderful hair. Anyway, Richard.
Where are we going with this?
I'm not sure where to go from there.
We've stunned him.
It was almost like you two had that on your script. You practiced we were recording.
Would you like me to talk about another Canadian?
Yes, please.
Go on then. We'll
talk about another Canadian. A Canadian mentioned a few weeks ago, actually, in the Annus Horribilis episode, because I'd lost track of this gentleman. We featured him in A Kilometre Zero, a friend special earlier in the year. It was called How to Become a Pro Cyclist. And this was about a gentleman called Jack Burke, a Canadian rider who had tried tirelessly over several years to make it into the World Tour, hadn't managed to do it, and had since written a book entitled precisely that, How to Become a Pro Cyclist. I think I'm getting the name right. Anyway, as I said, I lost track a little bit of Jack over the summer. And in this podcast a few weeks ago, I said that Jack was an example, one of several examples this year, of riders with this kind of would-be fairy tale story who had ultimately gone another year without achieving their dream. No sooner had we pressed stop on the recorder than Jack made the headlines around the cycling world, because he's been doing a bit of a tour of Central Europe, snaffling Strava KOMs, very illustrious KOMs as well. He beat the Stelvio KOM, the record on there. He beat Jai Hindley's time set in the 2020 Giro d'Italia by just over a minute. He then, I hope I'm getting the chronology right, Jack explains the chronology in the interview we're going to hear in a minute. But he also made headlines by taking over a minute of Vincenzo Nibali's time on the Mortirolo in Italy, clocking up 435 watts for 43 minutes and 55 seconds. And the latest KOM that Jack added to his collection very recently, just a few days ago, was Alpe d'Huez. This time, he bettered Sepp Kuss's record from 2022 by 9 seconds. This, chaps, has caused a sensation. It has led to headlines, speculation, reports that Jack might be bound for the World Tour after all. He's now, is he 28 or 29? He is, shall we say, he's in his late 20s while I look that up. Anyway, I thought it would be intriguing to find out, he's 29, I thought it'd be intriguing to find out from Jack himself exactly how close he is at the present moment to that elusive World Tour deal. And I thought it'd be useful as well to clear up maybe a few misconceptions about some of these Strava records and this sort of online breakthrough that he's had in this autumn of 2024. So let's hear from Jack, shall we? And then we'll maybe discuss what he says.
Yeah, okay. So to sort of catch up everywhere. So I'd basically been retired for like 18 months, and then I got talked into coaching, or a coach that I met through my podcast talked me into training again in May. Like I reached out to this guy, wanted to record a podcast at the end of April. I was so impressed by the guy that, and then by the end of it, he's saying he wants to coach me. And I'm thinking, well, for what? Like, I'm not like skiing or biking. And, so he talked me into coaching. So we started training in May. By August, I started doing all these amateur races, and I won all the amateur races I did this year. And then I posted some of that data up on Strava. And then some of my friends that race in the World Tour, after seeing that data, were like, dude, you should really be sending this to teams. So I won all those amateur by the end of September. Like, yeah, and start of
big,
October.
Just to interject, Jack, some big race, big amateur races, but big in the sort of Gran Fondo world. So, for example, exactly. The Ötzala Radmarathon, it's one of the biggest Gran Fondos in the world, isn't it? And you broke the record there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So then those were the ones that kind of got everybody's attention. But then the cycling season is done at the end of September, early October. But I was just kind of getting back into really good shape at that point because I started training so late. And then I came up with the side goal of doing the Zwift Academy thing because that would be my plan was still to race the World Cup ski mountaineering season this winter. And I came up with the side goal of doing the Zwift Academy thing because that would be a goal that would keep me in shape until the end of November. And then I could jump on my skis. Like it would just be like a middle goal. And if something good came of it, awesome. But I wasn't expecting anything. And then so I was doing all the trainer workouts, just trying to do the Zwift Academy thing. And I was so frustrated with it that I just like lost my shit one day because it's like nothing's connecting. Everything needs to be calibrated. I was just getting so frustrated with this thing. I just texted my coach and said, I finished today's workout, but tomorrow I'm going to take a rest day. And then the next day I'm going to drive to the bottom of the Stelvio. And I just want to test myself on that to see how I'm going. Because the trainer tells me I suck, but I think I'm doing better than this thing is telling me. And then so I drove to the Stelvio. I did that. And then my buddy, one of my friends who was with me, just made this terrible 5-second video of us just freezing at the top of the... And I put it on Instagram and then that went viral. And then I was like, oh, okay, I guess like people really like this stuff. And then I was just hanging out with my friends at Scott, Austria. So their headquarters is in Innsbruck, right close to me. Yeah. And some of my friends work there. And I was just hanging out with them. And they were like, Jack, we have a new bike for next year. You want to see it? And so they just lent it to me. And I was like, oh, I wonder if I could go after the Alpe d'Huez KOM. Because that like there's no snow there yet, but it was the middle of November. And then I just I told my friends about it. And they were like, we're coming. We're in. Like, this is going to be so fun. And then if you know Scott, the cycling Dane, the YouTube account, I told him about it.
So
I told him about it and he's like, oh, I'll meet you there and we'll film it. And I was like, okay, cool. And then so that was like, so the Stelvio, I did not plan at all. Like that was like 2 days notice. And it wasn't supposed to be anything. After that went well, I was like, okay, I'll do Alpe d'Huez then. This will be cool. And then so I went there with my friends and I got that record. And I mean, we were so excited after that, but I couldn't tell anybody for like 2.5 weeks because I did it with Scott's new bike and they hadn't released the bike yet.
Okay.
So they were like, you have to keep it a secret. And so that was driving me crazy. And then a couple days after that, I found out I didn't even make the first round cuts for Zwift Academy. And I was pissed because I was like, are you kidding? Like I can break the records of the two most famous climbs in cycling, but I'm not good enough to make the first round cuts. And then so
just
I was
explain,
like,
Jack, on what basis are those cuts made?
Well, I think it probably has to do with my age. Like I never expected to make it to the finals, but so you have 6 workouts and 2 races that you can do. And I won both the races and I did all the workouts and I figured I did well at them. But then I never heard anything. It was just like, oh, you didn't even make the first round cuts. Like you don't hear anything at that point. And so I was annoyed with that. So I was like, okay, fine. If I can't go get that and I can't tell anybody about Alpe d'Huez yet, I'm going to go for the Motorola then. And then that was just... That was probably my favorite one because it was, I just drove there in my car. It was like 4 hours from the place where I live. I just drove there in the morning. It was just me. Like I just went and just did this silly thing in the middle of, towards the end of November at this point. And I had such good legs that day. Like I just felt amazing. And I knew I was going to get the record, like maybe halfway up the climb. I could see I was going really well. And so it was just a really nice day on the bike, but there's no photos, there's no podium, there's nothing like that. It was just me out in the mountains by myself doing it. And then I posted that one. And the thing, so what all the journalists have gotten wrong from this, like people that didn't actually interview me about it, is I made the video on my Instagram account about when I did the Motorola. And I said, I'm not supposed to tell you guys about that. I cut out, like I said it in the video and then I cut it out after because I said Alpe d'Huez and I was like, shit, I can't tell anybody about that yet. But everybody thought I was talking about the Stelvio.
Okay.
So there was three, when I did the Motorola, I had 3 KOMs at the time, the Stelvio, Alpe d'Huez, and the Motorola, but I couldn't tell anyone about Alpe d'Huez yet.
Right.
But people got it wrong and said, oh, he hasn't told anybody about the Stelvio. And it's like, well, no, the Stelvio has been up for like a month. Right. It's Alpe d'Huez that I couldn't tell anybody about for like another 2 weeks or so.
Okay. Because one of the questions I had was that, obviously, as I said, there's been a lot of attention. And as you would expect with social media, there's Well, the reactions have ranged from sort of awe to deep skepticism. Is there been something that sort of frustrated you in the kind of people's reaction to it, something that people are missing? You know, if it was one, then people might say, oh, well, you know, we don't know what the weather conditions were like, or, you know, okay, he hasn't ridden 10 stages of a Tour de France before that. So, okay, one, we can understand, but three.
Yeah, so there's kind of like three things. So, I mean, the first one that's kind of the funniest to me is like people saying it's like, oh, well, we don't know. Like, he's doing this fresh. It's not halfway through a race or at the end of a Grand Tour or whatever this kind of stuff is. But every other race I won this year, okay, they're amateur races, but I broke the course record at all of them, and they're all over 200K and over 5,000 meters of climbing. And the funny thing to me, it's like this year has been the least professional I have ever trained, or the least that I've tried in my whole life. Like, since I was 14 years old, I was eat, sleep, and breathe cycling. That's it. Mm. Versus this year, I really lived like a hobby rider. Like, I was Jack the Athlete for 3 or 4 or 5 hours of the day, and then I go back into working like a normal human. Like, I really didn't. I was just doing it for fun up until a couple weeks ago, when people are like, oh, you could really go for a pro contract here. Like, and when people look at the numbers, I'm just like, my numbers were better in 2019 and 2021, but I never had a chance to show it because I was so close to, like, all I was thinking about my whole time in Europe is having a place to live and food to eat. Like, I had nothing for it. And now people see these amazing performances and they're like, how are you going so well after you were a continental rider for so long? And that's the part that hurts me, because I'm like, fuck, man. Like, I was doing better years ago, but I had no chance to show it, because you have nothing when you're here. And it's like, now I have a coach for the first time since I've been in Europe. I have a good bike to borrow, and I have a job which pays for me to live, so I can just enjoy riding my bike. I'm not stressed about rent being due in a few days and I don't have it.
Yeah. The job, like, being your book.
Exactly. Correct, yeah. Like, all the stuff that I do now. Like, that's the, I mean, if people saw the way I live right now, you'd think it's a joke. Like, my sleep and my nutrition are really not that great right now, because I haven't been focused on being an athlete. I just did it for fun, and I got going really well, but there was that. I mean, that it is funny, because it's like, I think it's now over 50 messages I have from riders, coaches, and managers in the World Tour, like the guys that are at that level, all saying, like, all of them, they all say, like, this is amazing, like, you should totally be in the World Tour, all this kind of stuff. And it's the people that, you know, have not raced at that level that are criticizing it. I mean, what are the points that I would say? I mean, doing it at the end of the race, of course, like, I know it's not the same as doing that. I'm the first one to say that, but I was just like, well, this is all I got. Like, I must've missed the sign-up sheet for the Tour de France the last couple of years. Like, I'm trying to get there. I would just say, like, if there's a point to be taken from this, it's that I'm maybe the example that shows just how hard it is to make it to the World Tour if you miss the under 23 cutoff and you're not from Europe. Because I've been in Europe for 5 years now, and just getting the chances to race is the hardest part. Like, you know, 2021, I had better numbers, but I did the first 6 races of the year without a front brake on my bike. You know, I've been in races where we don't have anyone to give us water in the race, so you're starting with a third bottle in your pocket, or we don't have spare wheels if you get a flat tire, or I broke my pelvis in 2022. Like, these are real things, but everyone's like, well, how come you didn't show it for how many years there? It's like, well, pro cycling stats doesn't show the whole story for it. Or the team deciding we don't want to go to races anymore because the team owner isn't motivated because other guys aren't training.
Yeah, and I think, like, the really sobering thing is that you mentioned the under 23 cutoff, and actually now that's kind of an under 18. It's a junior cutoff, it's becoming.
Exactly.
So it's even easier to miss the boat. Yeah, yeah.
And that's the point. Or so, like, I'd have these conversations with director. Like, I just had this conversation with Steven DeYoung on my podcast last night. And so, obviously, he's a coach for Lidl Trek. And I just asked him, I was like, if somebody misses the under 23 cutoff and they're not from Europe, how do you make it? And his advice was like, oh, well, you just got to get on the Conti teams and get results that way. But my point with that is the fact, like, if you're from Canada, the US, or Australia, how are you going to come to Europe and live on less than 500 euros a month, what these teams can pay you, and then try to get results? Like, that's impossible. You cannot do that anymore. And so when people see my performances, I'm like, look, I finally have a chance to show it somehow. It's not possible to show it in these continental teams.
The other sort of top line on all of this is, well, there was a story in the Dutch press. I don't know whether this was based on what you told them, but they said you have been contacted by 4 World Tour teams, and there's some kind of discussion going on with World Tour teams. Just bring us up to speed with that if you can.
Yeah, sure. Well, so now it's five teams, but one of them is Pro Conti.
Okay.
And then, so yeah, it's, they just messaged me on Instagram and stuff like that. So, I mean, yeah, but I also said
saying
in that
what?
Interview, like,
roughly,
just like, who are you? Like, can we have your training? Like, who are you?
Dude.
Can we have your can we have an interview with you? Like, that's basically it. And I was like, yeah, for sure. You want my Training Peaks, the keys to my car, the keys to my apartment, whatever you want. Like, you can have everything. Mm. But, so yeah, like, those teams reached out. I don't know where it goes because, like I said, like, I've been really close to making it a couple times. Like, I've gone through the scouting protocol with a couple big teams, and it's, there's a very big difference between them reaching out and just, like, wanting to know a bit of actually signing the contract. So I don't know.
Even listening to the podcast you did with the Cycling Dane, and when we spoke in spring, maybe I'd missed this part, but you talked about your experience of doing training camps with Israel Premier Tech, and I did find myself ask myself, how come that hadn't led to at least some kind of gig on their development team?
Yeah, so that's the big. So that was 2021, and so the way that happened was 2021. I bet the whole season. On basically there was one race that would have been an opportunity for me. I was flying for that. And a week before I found out I wasn't selected for the race because the team only wanted to take Austrian riders to the race because it would make the sponsors happy because we were an Austrian team. And I'm like, what the fuck? You're taking guys that haven't finished a race this whole year. I have a shot at winning this race. And then the next day I got a phone call from Israel saying like, hey, do you want to join this training camp? I did the training camp with them. It couldn't have gone better. And so and Chris Froome was really pushing for me to get on the team. So I got invited to a second training camp with them. And like, I did everything possible at that, but I didn't have any results at the end of the year. And the way they see it is they see my pro cycling stats and see this guy's killing everybody at training camp, but he doesn't have a race win yet. Mm. Why is that the case? What doesn't show up on pro cycling stats is I did half of that season without a front brake on my bike. Mm. And the other half of the season, it's like, we don't have anyone to give us water or if you get a flat tire.
Mm.
Like, you don't have the most basic stuff, but that doesn't show up on pro cycling stats. And so people just think you must not know how to race your bike. And it's like, that's not the whole story.
Mm. On, because obviously one of the charges always sort of leveled at people who take unconventional routes, whether it's the Zwift Academy or something of that ilk, is bike skills, bike craft, in bunch skills, race craft. How do you feel on that front? How prepared do you feel to ride in the World Tour?
I mean, okay, so if I was to jump into the World Tour next year, for sure it would take me a couple races to get back into it because I've been away from it for a year or two. What I would point to, though, to those people is, like, I would say look at the end of my 2019 season, because 2019 was the only real year in Europe where I was on a great team with Leopard. That was a wonderful development team. I got tons of chances to race, and that was my first time coming to Europe, and so I spent until maybe August of that year just learning how to race, like just figuring all that stuff out, because I was strong coming from North America, but you have to learn all those bike handling skills. And it took me until, let's say, the start of August before I started to kind of get it and figure it out. Mm. And then if you look at the results that I have in like August, September, and October, I was doing the races that are the worst for my skill set. Like, I was doing one-day classics in Belgium, which are like, I'm better suited for the mountains, so those are not the races for me. But I was at least in the front, making the front splits for all of those races. That's what I would point to. And then that's when, like, Steve Bauer, for example, he was working for CCC at the time. He reached out to me after he watched me. And I think Le Femme Ardennes Classic was one of the harder ones where a lot of really good guys didn't finish, but I did okay in that. Like, I was basically the worst guy in the front group for all of those races because I couldn't sprint to save my life, but at least I was making the front splits. That, to me, like, the end of my 2019 season is when I sort of proved to myself that it's like, okay, I do know how to race now. I can make the breaks and the front splits here, the races that are the worst for me. Mm. But then the following years, it's like you just never have the chances to race. Or another one that people look at all the time is if you look at my 2022 season, they see sixth place at Tour of Upper Austria and then top 20 in Tour of Slovenia. Yeah. I broke my pelvis 4 weeks before Upper Austria. Like, when I got sixth place there, I only started walking the week before that race. And then Tour Slovenia, that was 5 weeks after breaking my pelvis. So it's like I was doing that with like no fitness for that. That was when I had zero engine because I was on crutches for a month before that. And then it's like they see that. It's like, oh, well, okay, I guess maybe he can position himself. It's like, well, I did that only with positioning because I had zero engine at that point.
Jack, two last points of order, I suppose. So these messages that you've received from World Tour teams, these communications, have they led thus far to anything concrete? Is there anything in the diary, i.e., you know, you are going for a physiological test with someone in the next few weeks, or is it still just inquiries?
It's mostly just inquiries. Like, they all just reached out, like, I guess it'd be like 2 weeks ago now. And so it's just been, can we have your training peaks? Can we see your data? And can we just have like a meeting with you? Like, can we just talk to you on the phone? That's it. And then I'm just basically waiting to hear back from that.
Okay. Can you name the teams?
I don't want it, like, because I don't want to jinx anything. That's all.
I understand. Last thing, Jack, have you ever had sense, or has it been spelled out to you, that you're doping positive when you were, how old were you? Remind me, very young.
18.
And you explained in great detail, both in your book and on the podcast we did, the circumstances around that. And to a large extent, you were wholly exonerated in sort of in substance, if not in sort of sanction. Have you had any sense that that is an obstacle?
Yeah, for sure. So like I was really naive to this for a long time, because basically when the first couple of years that I went through it, you get so much hate mail from all these people. But then I later realized the only people that were saying that stuff were people that were like below me, like they wanted it to be true. It was never coming from people that I respected or admired or that were at the pro level. And I understood that. But then years later, I found out that there were a handful of continental teams that and development teams that thought I was a good enough rider, that I was like better than a lot of the guys on the team, but they wouldn't take me because they just didn't want the bad press for their sponsors heard. And then I sort of like after years of it, like the truth had gotten out and everybody that wanted to read the details would see it's like, okay, he did nothing wrong. Like all the courts said he did nothing wrong. There's no sanction, nothing. But even still, like I know I went through the scouting protocol with one of the big World Tour teams. And they said, it's like, look, we know you didn't do anything wrong. We know this is like not, you did nothing wrong here and we completely believe you, but it is a problem for some of our sponsors. Like they just don't want the bad press. And then that really hurt when I was like, fuck man, like everybody knows I didn't do anything wrong here. Nobody thinks I did anything wrong and it's still hurting me there. Like there's nothing more I can do here. And so, yeah, like that does come up. And then like, even there's definitely, like a lot of these development or some of these World Tour teams, they just read the headline. Like they don't dive into it that deep and they just assume it's like, oh, like, or I think one of the feedback from one of them was the fact that it's like, oh, well, this happened in the past. And I'm like, well, that's not the story. The story is not that, oh, I tested positive years ago, but it was 11 years ago. It's that I lost my life because of something I had, like, I was wrongly accused of this and it ruined my life. Like I got knocked. I went from being the best junior in Canada and one of the best ones in North America. And now for years, I've been watching the guys that I was beating as a junior have been racing Grand Tours for years. Like I didn't do anything wrong here. It's not that this is in the past and he's been rehabilitated or something like that. It's like, no, I never did anything wrong. And it's still hurting for that.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
So, fellas, I'm keen to hear from you. What do you make of all of that? Because I think it's natural to greet this whole story with some curiosity, surprise, but also maybe a bit of skepticism, focusing on no particular aspect of it, but it does somehow seem a little bit implausible. What do you think?
I honestly, Danny, I don't know what I think. I wish I could. Like I said, there is that little hint of skepticism, not in a nasty way, just because I'm not au fait with it. I mean, it's sort of that time of year, isn't it, where there's all these stories going on. To me at the minute, given the fact that there's not much live road broadcasting going on, and I've been working on the track, to me it's sort of background noise that at the minute. They're obviously impressive rides. There's no doubt about that. There's the fact there. You've got the time up on Strava and what have you. Again, is it the same doing it when it's not racing?
Well, it's not, is it?
You know,
it's not.
There's that as well.
And Jack, yeah, and Jack says that, you know, and also he sort of explains himself there, the World Tour question, you know, there are good reasons. He's under no illusions about why that World Tour contract hasn't materialized. Part of it is lack of results in the races that matter. Part of it is the doping issue, which I alluded to there, which for which he got a reprimand when he was a junior, but he was basically cleared. It was contaminated drinking water that caused him to test positive. Yeah, Richard, what I mean, certainly it's a very valid point, and it's one that we've discussed before about this rush to sign younger and younger riders and that creating the risk for very talented late blooming athletes to slip through the net.
For young Jack Burke at 29. It's interesting, isn't it, how across the sport, but I also think like in terms of other industries as well, how things have been democratized. Like you think about publishing and music as well, probably one of the first industries to do this, where actually the barriers to entry were really reduced so that anybody could put anything out there. Music, that's just, you know, record something in your bedroom, put it on Spotify, done, or iTunes, whatever. Publishing, self-publish anything you like, get it on Amazon, done. And these days everybody could have access, well, up to a point, you still need equipment, but access to training plans, to software, to the sort of science behind how a professional cyclist trains, stuff that hitherto would have been quite elusive, would have been contingent on being involved in a top level team or outfit or national federation, whatever, that is now essentially open to all. So the barriers for entry are quite low. But then again, if everybody's doing it, if everybody's out there putting these sorts of, okay, not everybody's taking the KOM on the Mortirolo and Alpe d'Huez or whatever, but you know, if you're a World Tour team manager or coach, you actually, there'll be dozens if not hundreds of people who are putting forward their power numbers and training data to you. How do you decide what makes for a good World Tour rider or a rider that you think has potential in that kind of environment? It's not hard to imagine, you know, for someone like in Jack's position, like that opportunity that he has now just wouldn't have existed, would it, 10 years ago? Because, well, maybe, I mean, Strava existed, but I think the willingness of World Tour teams to even consider that sort of slightly left field approach, you know, look for riders who are coming from perhaps other sports or riders who haven't, for whatever reason, been able to make the most or seize that chance that they might have had when they were juniors or under 23s. So it's interesting, isn't it? But then, you know, you contrast that with Matt Winston and what he was talking about with DSM and their emphasis on having all these men and women on their development team basically living together or close to each other in Sittard in the Netherlands, isn't it? And, you know, Daniel, you and I worked on that interviews with all the class of the academy from 20 years ago, you know, and that was very much part of it. What Rod Ainsworth's approach was get all these people together, sort of living, and then you see what they're made of. And quite often the most talented riders in terms of numbers and like physical attributes weren't the ones that made it, because there's a whole lot more that goes into making a World Tour rider.
A dark shadow falls over door number 16 because it's the controversial Lance Armstrong. It's 16 years since Lance Armstrong announced his comeback to the sport, breaking through all of the unworthy dross to finish on the podium of the Tour de France the following summer. Has it really been 16 years? Behind door number 17, it's an exciting UCI commissaire. 17 metres equals a 1 second gap in a bunch sprint, apparently. And this is a gap which is used to calculate splits in the group as a peloton crosses the line. A gap which is being extended to 3 seconds next year, equating to 50 metres, in order to make a breakthrough in rider safety. Behind door number 18 is Paul Seixas. Sexas. Sexias. The next Bernardino, finally, a French Tour de France winner, surely. No pressure. Door number 19 is hiding a couple of breakthrough riders, aged 19, Paul Manier and Jan Christen. This is getting easier now, being able to use age as a number. Kind of feels like cheating. Well, there's something a bit different behind door number 20. It's Jonas Abrahamsen, and 20 is the number of kilos put on by Abrahamsen after he started eating like a normal person. He also grew 6 centimetres in his mid-20s, thereby breaking through his living room ceiling like the granny in George's Marvelous Medicine. Maybe there's hope for me yet to grow taller, if I just really focus on eating more.
Jonas Abrahamsen. It was a bit of a breakthrough year, and I talked about this a few weeks ago. Eating, wasn't it? Food. fueling. It was a huge topic of conversation this year, and that was sort of embodied, exemplified by Abrahamsen. Chaps, yesterday I was listening to a podcast, one of my favourite podcasts, the Rich Roll podcast, about an ultra runner called David Roach, who won the Leadville trail race last year. And he credited his success with taking this whole sort of fueling revolution to a different level and sometimes ingesting as many as 150 grams or even more of carbohydrates per hour. And David Roach had practiced this where he'd studied for Leadville effectively by looking closely at the world of competitive eating. Things like pie-eating contests. And he had picked up a lot of tips and a lot of info on how one prepares one's gut for that kind of extreme eating from that world. Rob, have you ever taken part in a pie-eating contest?
No, I don't like pies.
Not a pie-throwing contest, Rob.
Ha, 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 ha. Been a few years since I've thrown some pies down anyway. Don't worry about that. I'll probably wake up and struggle to get out of bed the next morning. Pie-eating, no. Despite of my Lancastrian roots, I don't like pies, which won't surprise you anyway.
Have either of you chaps experimented with super high carb intake?
I've eaten a lot of pizzas on one night. Yeah.
I think there might have been a day on the Tour de France where somebody bought like one of those Nutella cookie bags. I think I was probably hitting 150 grams an hour then, as were three of us. But as an athletic endeavour, no. It's a lot, isn't it?
It's a huge amount.
I mean, it's just a number, 150 grams, but when you break that down into, well, how many gels that would be, or add in energy drinks and then solid food as well, it's to the point where athletes find it difficult to keep that down.
This subject is pretty ubiquitous at the moment. It's been discussed in a lot of different places, from sort of pop physiology podcasts to, obviously, there are a lot of scientific studies happening or have happened over the last few years. What I am able to glean from what I'm reading is that this is even might even still go to another level in the next year. David Roach on this particular podcast, he was citing studies about the effects on the brain and the nervous system and how that might be the real sort of secret source, as well as what's happening in the muscles. And there could be further sort of eureka moments on that score, further discoveries on that score, I think, in the next few months. So, once again, as mentioned a few weeks ago, a big year for eating.
And it was a cool story, Jonas Abrahamsen's as well, and he spoke pretty well about it. He did, I think what kicked it off was that he did a piece for Norwegian or Danish... Yep.
Post-naked, was it Norwegian for TV? TV too, yeah.
And it involved a sort of naked photo shoot, didn't it? Much in the vein of Chris Froome's, when Chris Froome did one in the Vuelta a few years ago when he was, I think it was the Vuelta that he won off the top of my head. The difference being Chris Froome, very lean, very Chris Froome-y, and Jonas Abrahamsen, post 20 kilos of weight, was sort of very body positive about it all. And I remember asking him at the tour, like, what was the secret to putting on that weight in a kind of sustainable, healthy, lean, athletic way? And he was like, no, I just ate more cake and biscuits and stuff. And I'm like, okay. Fair enough.
Sounds brilliant, doesn't it?
It does sound, yeah, particularly
didn't ask about pies.
No. No, would be very helpful, particularly in December, wouldn't it? Mm. That particular strategy.
That's my winter chaps, training plan. That's it. He's decided it for me. Quality street pizza and a few bike rides. Here we go.
20 kilogram target.
Problem is, I think I achieved that without getting the training in. Sorry, Daniel. Let's carry on, mate.
Shall we cross a final time to Killian in Dublin for our final windows on the advent calendar? It's December 21st, 24th.
On the home straight now, and I'm using age to cheat again, because door number 21 contains Romain Grégoire, who was 21 when he won a stage of the Tour of the Basque Country. The only riders younger to have won a stage of that race have been Carlos Rodriguez and Gino Bartali. Behind door number 22 is, I think, the most interesting one. 22 is the average age of all of the teams at the 2024 Tour de France. Not the age of the riders, it's the average number of years each team had existed. The narrative always seems to be that the way the sport is organised is unsustainable, but teams have never been more stable. Perhaps a breakthrough for the entire sport. Knocking on door number 23 reveals the Under 23 World Road Race, won this year by Niklas Behrens. The Under 23 Road Race, of course, is a fertile ground for riders breaking through, but Behrens' two companions on the podium, Martin Zverček and Alex Sejar, are the last of their kind World Tour riders in the Under 23 race, as the rule is due to change next year to ban World Tour riders from taking part. And finally, behind the last door on the Cycling Podcast Advent Calendar is Pablo Castrillo, who took two cracking stage wins at the Vuelta España. He is the first Spanish rider in 24 years to win multiple stages of his first Grand Tour since Oscar Freire in the year 2000, when he was aged, yes, 24.
Behind door 22, says Killian, is the most interesting one. Average age of all teams at the 2024 Tour de France, not the age of the riders, it's the average number of years each team has existed. That is, chaps, a sort of symptom, a sign of health, isn't it, to a certain extent in professional cycling? Something that probably would have been inconceivable a few years ago. The sustainability, apparently, of World Tour teams.
I would just throw caution to the statistics there, in that, is it the same team if the sponsors are totally different or the ownership structure is totally different? And the fact that they are long-lived...
As long as somebody doesn't come and buy it out or something like that, it's the same team, isn't it?
Yeah, give me an example. By definition, I think...
Visma Lisa bike.
Yeah,
how far back are we taking their story?
Can definitely make a case for that. I'm not sure. I can't remember off the top of my head exactly what happened with the license, but Richard Plugger was certainly part of Rabobank, and it changed name to Belkin. I think definitely there's definitely a through line. Enough of a through line there.
There's a through line in terms of like the organisers and the sort of DNA and the staff and the makeup of the team and that sort of thing. But in terms of the sustainability and the health of it from a business perspective, there were definitely those Belkin Blanco years weren't exactly...
But it was like, the same team. You're not telling me that Accrington Stanley and Accrington FC aren't the same, no?
Michael,
come on.
Just because Michael
it was the same,
just because Michael
the same team, but
not still riding for them. It's not the same
not.
Team.
But if Visma and Lisa Bike suddenly decided to pull the plug next year,
the
team
sponsor?
Might not exist. It doesn't change the sustainability or the vulnerability of a team, does it? Just because it's been long-lived.
I think, generally speaking... If you look at the length of the contracts behind that statistic, or the contracts with sponsors, I think that generally the trend has been towards more sustainable agreements with sponsors as well. Okay, teams have fallen by the wayside over the last few years, but there've also been a lot of examples of teams that have organizations, management structures that have weathered storms of sponsors falling by the wayside and teams nonetheless surviving, and I think that's a good thing, Richard.
No,
bad Santa Scrooge. just you know, rejoice. Well, chaps, that concludes the Advent episode. Still about 3 weeks, not quite 3 weeks until Christmas. Lots of windows still to open on our respective Advent calendars. But that was our episode celebrating, showcasing, talking about those chaps who announced their arrival on the scene in 2024. Next week, a continuation, yet another Review of the Year episode, we are going to be talking about another promising young rider who excelled in 2024. His name is Tadej Pogačar. He's from Slovenia. And the whole episode is going to be dedicated, after several weeks of doing our best not to talk about him too much, we're going to throw off the shackles next week, and it's going to be a whole sort of tribute to this incredible year that he had in 2024. So, chaps, in anticipation of that, in the meantime, I'm going to thank you for your company, and and Rob, we'll be seeing each other in a week's time, and Richard, we'll be seeing you in a bit more than a week.
Ciao.
Bye.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.